Hello, and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks and the Learning College. I'm Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and also later permanently archived at alexlinder.com. Today we're going to do a section from Chapter 8 of James Mason's Siege. Chapter 8 is called Leaders. We're going to do sections 8.1 through 8.11. Page 383 to 402. So it'll take about maybe 50 minutes. Again, section 8 is called Leaders. It begins with some epigraphs. First, I know that some man capable of giving our problems a final solution must appear, and that is why I've set myself to do the preparatory work, only the most urgent preparatory work, for I know that I myself am not the one, and I know also what is missing in me to be the one, but the other one still remains aloof, and nobody comes forward, and there is no more time to be lost. That's Adolf Hitler, as quoted by Hans Grimm in 1928. So he's saying, I know I'm not the one, but you know what? I'll do until he gets here, because he's not showing up and there's stuff to be done, and I'm going to do the most urgent preparatory work, Hitler said in 1928. Again, from Hitler, the man they have most reviled stands closest to us, and the man they hate worst is our best friend, Adolf Hitler. Quote, our motto continues to be, white man, stand with us and fight, or stand out of our way, George Lincoln Rockwell. Next, from Tomasi, leadership in the struggle has to do with making things happen. Leadership is the people who are doing it, cutting through diversionary debate, smashing forms and familiarities that hold us back, and through developing and acting on a clear line of how we move to win, redefining the context, content, and meaning of the National Socialist Movement and the Revolution. That's what we call seizing the time. Joseph Tomasi. Again, from Same, our greatest weakness is our belief in our own weakness. We have to communicate to all National Socialist revolutionaries our strength. And to show them our strength, we have to show them the strength of fighting. We must build confidence within the entire movement before we can hope to help people and lead those people in revolution. Finally, I got no dead heroes. That was said by Charles Manson. 8.1. Sum total. Perhaps the hardest thing that National Socialists, pro-NS types, and even revisionist historians have to deal with is the question of what effect did Hitler have on the world he lived in, and what did he leave behind? Of course, the other side has no such difficulty and is quite clear and outspoken on the matter. They simply say that Hitler caused the greatest disaster in human history, and, not only that, but also caused the direct demise of everything he himself believed in and was fighting for. That is to say, the end of fascism as a potent force, the end of Germany as a united and independent nation, plus the spread of Bolshevism over most of Europe. Those are the failures, quote-unquote, they attach to his debit side. Paramount among his accomplishments, they list the slaughter of 6 million Jews. That one, at least, we have the answer for ready at hand. Let us back up within our own framework and state up front that the historical facts as we know them tell us plainly that the three horrifically destructive things above were outcomes of the Second World War, a war that was forced upon Germany, not a war that Hitler sought, but a war engineered by Big Brother forces to get their master plan, i.e. world government, back on track after Hitler had messed it up in 1933. And not just a few Jewish and pro-Jewish writers, as opposed to true historians, have openly stated in their books, Hitler was the one personage and event of the 20th century that wasn't supposed to happen. That means that he wasn't planned, at least not by them. The Federal Reserve System here was planned. The First World War, including its outcome, was planned. The Russian Revolution was planned. The League of Nations was planned. The destruction and betrayal of Germany to Bolshevism was planned as the linchpin to Lenin's revolution, and nearly was an accomplished fact. But in came Hitler. Dot, dot, dot. The provenance of that selection is not known. 8.2, an honest man. Hitler's personal qualities, which clearly come through in Mein Kampf, a hot potato for the Jews, as they can't burn it or otherwise suppress it for fear of drawing too much attention, but can only forewarn you that it'll bore you to death, are painfully striking in these, quote, modern times. Total honesty, total conviction, and total courage. No compromises and no evasions. Here are the facts. Here is what I'm doing. What are you going to do? Hitler was a humble man and a man of the people, if ever there was one. What he wanted for Germany and the German people, he wanted for Germany and the German people, not for himself. He would have had Germany win the First World War, in which he risked his own life many times, so as to have been just a small part afterwards in its national life. He would have rather helped someone else in the task of resurrecting Germany after 1918, but then, just as now, everybody seemed to be waiting. So an honest man of the people did it himself. Aside from positively infuriating the behind-the-scenes Big Brother systemites in Moscow and New York, Hitler caused unlimited resentment and chagrin among the stooges of the system of his day because he wasn't, quote, qualified to do what he was doing. He didn't have the social background for world statesmanship, which he had assumed in the role of German chancellor. It was this latter resentment among petty European, nominally white politicians that facilitated the war that would erupt in 1939. They claim Winston Churchill to be the man of the century, but friend and foe alike should stop and ask themselves who'd remember Churchill today had not Hitler entered upon the scene. Churchill was their most willing and handy tool, and as soon as his task was performed, he was discarded by them. Which brings us to the pivotal year of 1945. No real history has been recorded since 1945. Nothing of a positive upward nature has occurred since then. Some technology has been developed which threatens to destroy us all. Some infectious diseases have been curtailed, while degenerative disease now seems to be all in all our futures. Civilization is crumbling and dying. And they say, quote, the best man always wins. Yet we, as National Socialists, are aware that Hitler and Goebbels and thousands of others were talking about ultimate victory even on their personal day of demise. Was this propaganda or were they insane, as the Jews and their friends tell us? Any intelligent mind should know that no man and no organization of men can achieve what Hitler and the NSDAP achieved by telling lies and being unbalanced. And there is no way that a sacrifice of the magnitude of Germany can have been for nothing. Volume 12, Number 11, November 1983. 8.3, the meaning of Hitler. People, even National Socialists, get the two dimensions of Hitler mixed up and thereby lose the actual concept of what he was in reality. There was the inspired philosopher and reformer, then there was the inspired politician and statesman. History has been full of the first type, and equally full of the second type, but never together in the same man. Aside from this, Hitler was entirely a man of his people, racially, physically, and psychically and culturally. He was gifted with extraordinary personal qualities. He was entirely fearless, selfless, absolutely dedicated to his people. What he accomplished amounts to the greatest miracle in history. Against every odd, there was the philosophy, the party, the revolution, the Third Reich, and even the war itself. No one man has ever accounted for so much on his own, all within 25 years. As far as we today are concerned, those who are living to perpetuate and advance Hitler's work, or at least live up to his example, need to understand what he meant historically. His movement and his government represented the last time the workings of the old order would ever be harnessed and put to use for the good of the whites of any respective nation. Hitler was the last chance for the revival of Western civilization. Actually, Hitler was not a Westerner. That's been said by a number of people. And so in that sense, it is practically useless for us to attempt to emulate him today, for that phase is past. For those who are aware of this, then, the choice is clear, but it is not easy. Either dream in the past or live in the present, at the same time while fighting for the future. Volume 12, Number 3, March 1983. 8.4. A man. The man. It's worth saying again and again that the failing of the movement has not been one of name or symbolism, but of strategy and tactics. A few of our own best people have correctly observed that should a great mind and personality exist with the potential of becoming another Hitler, he would positively want nothing to do with the movement in its present state. He would be instantly repelled by the idiocy, the smallness, the futility, and the negative connection with the dead past. But such a mind would, by nature, be committed to a course of open action, just as Hitler was. He would waste no time in gathering followers and in making himself known to the world, and to every household, in his own original way. But how? And what would be the world's reaction, as well as the reaction of the individual? One way of knowing is to recall how the world reacted and still reacts to Hitler. The Jews are cunning, and the individual is blind and stupid. Someone of an extraordinary nature must be among us somewhere in one guise or another. Not one more faker either, but a personality of extraordinary proportions. When one takes into account that Hitler was joined by many great men, then there is room to accept that more than one must exist today. The times are still early, historically. Volume 10, Number 9, September 1981, that was. 8.5, What to Look For and How to Look. Forget about knights on white horses or a stereotype right-wing superhero in a three-piece suit. Forget about middle America, or any one of those slobs arising out of the middle class, or the silent majority. Expect them to remain silent throughout. Certainly you can forget about any current right-wing leaders ever amounting to a damn, either by supreme sacrifice on the part of their memberships, or through blind luck. They are committed to defeat. In fact, no one who says he is it is likely to be it. You can throw out all the old rule books accumulated over the decades. You cannot discover the right man either by searching through the system or its media, or by him trying to reach you through the media or the system. He will not proceed by established rules. Avoid all the symptoms of head-up-the-ass syndrome if you were to keep your eyes open wide. Moralism, squeamishness, prudery, bourgeois hang-ups, right-wingism, reaction, etc. Stop looking in all the wrong places. If things are as barren as the right-wing formula would indicate, then we are truly lost. And I cannot accept that as being the case. Try thinking logically. The right man would know instinctively, or would learn very fast, that the system would never knowingly allow a real leader of the people to arise. Therefore, he will never represent himself as such. This all at once rules out the fakers and the assholes. He would be well aware of the state of the masses of people, and would therefore not be a politician or follow a political course geared to a hope of a mass following. He would know already that the people cannot recognize their own leader. He would see that a formal movement or organization cannot be successfully built, the system won't allow it, and therefore his every move could be expected to defy all convention. Being primarily a man of action, he would know better than most that the truth remains for the moment our only and best weapon. Therefore, he would know how to put it to best use. Since the deaths of Rockwell and Tomasi, there has not been a personality type to fill the gap of possessing a magnetic and commanding presence. Aside from the right wing being mainly all chiefs and no Indians, what right wingers that do make up the rank and file, for the most part, are of notoriously poor quality and have been the bane of the entire movement. The right man would have to be quality in order to attract quality types around him. The right, worse than just words, is mostly paper words at that, dry and dead. This man would possess the power of the spoken word, which is the spark to revolutionary action. He would most probably follow in the classic mold of greatness, in that his apprenticeship in life would have been long and his career would only have begun at about the age of 30. One other thing. He would know the value of symbolism, and he would choose the swastika as his symbol. Volume 10, Number 9, September 1981. 8.6. Men of Ill Repute. In this movement, a man of ill repute is one who scares the hell out of and embarrasses the fakers by approaching kindling temperature and bringing down the heat. I've done this two or three times in the recent past, which is why I am my own publisher today. I've yet to scare myself. But Siege might be called a publication of ill repute because it serves as part of a larger force geared toward the implementation of everything printed in these pages. It is action-oriented, not idle chatter. The majority of the rest are great when it comes to telling it like it was, or when it comes to singing the blues, both of which are very safe and even profitable. We, however, are more concerned with now and with where we go from here. Hitler and Rockwell were not mere philosophers or writers, they were men of action, men who acted upon their words. Let us right now reclaim an old Anglo-Saxon word, heretofore long since stolen and perverted by our racial enemies, and used when describing their own minions to the unsuspecting world, men of integrity. How often have you heard that applied to complete scum-suckers until the sight and sound of it alone is enough to sicken? The definition of integrity, one definition, is simply completeness. And to me, this would entail a man who can think, speak, and act. What this also then means is that men of integrity are hated and feared in this movement. They are, in essence, leaders, who, again, by their nature, threaten the livelihood of crooks and fakers. Rockwell himself wrote it again and again that the white race is dying from a lack of leadership. And in more recent times, we have seen others. Joseph Tomasi, who first set this movement on a completely revolutionary course. At this point, it should come as no surprise to anyone that I would include in the first rank the name of Charles Manson, probably the farthest ahead of his time, for having done, in fact, many of the things outlined in the highly futuristic, but nonetheless straight down the line, Turner Diaries. Those bogged down in system thought processes hate men of action, but Rockwell knew, and as he wrote and demonstrated, the people will only respond to a man of action. Any other than a man of action is effectively invisible. The truth will not make you free. Only action. How easy it has been for them to suppress all our truth. Not so easily can they hide action. It has the effect of leaving the fakers and the parasites standing alone and exposed as in the middle of a 40-acre field. It is electrifying. It is unifying. It builds the confidence to go on toward even greater things. One thing pretty much for sure is that we may take a cue from our communist adversaries and look at what were known in the 40s and 50s as transmission belts. And as unpalatable as it may be for many in the movement, it was said of Stalin that what kept him in power over the huge worldwide communist apparatus was not the terror at his command, but the faith, the trust and the respect that his name inspired in the rank and file. Men are more apt to make sacrifices for those whom they look up to, for those men have made even greater personal sacrifices or have gained far greater results themselves. And that kind of stature doesn't come quick or easy. Commander Rockwell certainly had it. Joe Tomasi had it. The number is few. The man of ill repute today must one day go on to emerge as the hero that he is, just as our entire movement must emerge as the savior of an entire people. And the fever of action orientation must break out of the isolation it presently is in and assume infectious proportions before our revolution can hope to sweep over the land, taking every obstacle in its path. But it all begins with a proper thought. Those with a lot of rethinking to do had better get started. Volume 11, Number 7, July 1982. 8.7. Promise destroyed, promised destruction. At the height of Western development, that is, during the mid and later 19th century, the best brains and philosophers accurately predicted what the next century would hold for the Western man, the white race, and that was Adolf Hitler, National Socialism, and the Third Reich in Germany. As hard as it is for many of us today to view the affairs of Western life in the 19th century as anything but grand and glorious, those great philosophers, such as Nietzsche, hated their own times and projected towards something much brighter to come over the next two or three generations in Europe. Come it did, like a miraculous resurrection following the disaster of the First World War, and the future could hardly have appeared more secure. Hitler was the embodiment of that which the best had foretold, from Wagner to Chamberlain, from Gobineau to Grant, not only the fulfillment of German national destiny, but the answer to the total dilemma of the West, the promise of the future of Aryan man to be built upon the foundations already laid from the time of the Renaissance, the Crusades, and even before, to complete the compassing of the globe and to go on to reach out for the universe. Only a lunatic or an otherwise fevered brain could have conceived even a tiny glimpse of the Götterdämmerung of Europe, the Second World War, which ended, for all time, that promise that had begun with the very beginnings of the West itself, following the collapse of Rome and of classical civilization. In that sense, true history came to a halt in 1945. Since that time, what we have witnessed has amounted strictly to the decomposition of the dead body of what had been traditionally known as the West, and the process enters high gear as we look about us today. Our best latter-day philosophers, from Francis Parker Yockey, author of Imperium, to William Gailey Simpson's excellent work, Which Way Western Man, and even including Commander Rockwell's contribution to the field, White Power, all trace the growth, the decline, and the final destruction in their sagas of the West, the world in which they each matured and lived. They analyze the death symptoms and place the blame and responsibility squarely where they belong. But with regard to the future, they all agree in the same thing as well. Either the suicidal trends are reversed mighty shortly, or all culture perishes forever. None of them are able to offer any bright ray of hope, any assurances whatsoever, as did their predecessors 100 years ago. They pose the challenge of whether we will be able to put the lie to that maverick of thought among them, Oswald Spengler, who said so long ago that we were finished after all. And that is precisely where we stand today. Perhaps the one solid development that has occurred within the movement in recent years, very recent years, is the consensus that not only is the total destruction of the worldwide system and establishment inevitable now, but it is our only best hope. Not even Spengler himself could have foreseen a twist like that. Those of us within the traditional movement are today running a dangerous risk of going down with a past that we refuse to turn loose of. The old NS phrase that announces that we are not the last star of the evening, but the first star of the morning, is hollow and trite by contemporary smug definitions of past and future. Adolf Hitler represented the end of one world historic era, and the man who represents the start of a new one either has not appeared or he has not yet been recognized. This man, whoever he may be, will however definitely pick up where Hitler left off. Of that we may assure ourselves. There have been in the past, and still are today, many men who can be considered as great leaders and pointers of the way. So far, though, they have all been of a single mold, and so far, none of their results have even approached the spectacular, much less the epoch-making, which is, after all, what is required. We must have a total break with the past if we are to survive it. This means, in very practical terms, that we must, take up looking in places other than those to which we become too familiarly accustomed. We must broaden our scope. Now, if our latter-day prophets in the line of Yaqui, etc., were unconsciously saying something profound when they apparently left us hanging with the specter of desolation, then it would mean that a man would one day come to take all these loose, unexplained, incomprehensible ends into his hands and make something of them that we could use, that we could understand and follow. If a man never wrote anything of his own, that would make it all the much harder for the rest of us to see and to know him. But there was once before a prophet who wrote nothing in his own lifetime and who was recognized only after his death. In our supposed present level of higher enlightenment, we might hope to avoid the repeat of such a tragedy and embarrassment. But can we? Historic phases come and go, but the historic pattern doesn't change. Rockwell might say that unless we were able to be abandoned by Providence itself, as he frequently referred to it, then it seemed impossible to believe that we could be kept thus down forever. That would have to be then the kernel of our essence that keeps us believing. And in line with this thought would be the repeating historic pattern of a man being sent amongst us at the moment of crisis to make the critical difference. We must not fall into the trap of stereotyping the kind of individual, from where and in what manner, who might fulfill this historic promise. First of all, would he not have to be totally apart, right from birth, from this system and this establishment, if he truly were to be a prophet for the future of our race? And in terms of practicality, what would this mean? Might not it mean someone you'd hesitate to sit next to at a coffee counter? Would it not mean a total outlaw? Second, would not a man with such an historic mission to accomplish be one of extraordinary powers of personality, mannerism, and speech? Would he not be a leader of exceptional magnitude? And would the system, could it, afford to allow such a man to roam free to do his natural work? Third, would this man with a sacred awareness act the part of our typical right-wing fakers, i.e. a pretentious lout all decked out in a gaudy uniform and demanding fealty from a handful of pitiful defectives like some idiot? Or would he be found to be living in his one-on-one existence in a microcosm of the exact same position as our whole people lives in harsh reality, at the very bottom? He would be for real, and in this world in its current state, for real means not very pretty. Have we the guts to look it in the face, even if it means our own lives? This is only another way I am trying to show the movement of approaching Charles Manson, for there is a great deal more to him than is generally supposed. I say only that the case merits a closer look on the part of each and every National Socialist who desires to be part of the future. To scorn the strange man in the shaggy beard who sits locked in a system jail simply because he doesn't fit some set standard for what we might be expecting or hoping for is to be very foolish indeed. Be on the lookout for the thief in the night. It isn't that we've been looking at all the obvious places, because, from an historic standpoint, we simply haven't been. We've been looking in all the easy places, rather like sitting in one's living room at home and watching the progression of clowns pass before the screen of the TV over a period of years. The stakes themselves, and the nature of the circumstances, should tell anyone of logical mind that nothing about this will be pleasant or easy, let alone conventional. I've been assured that things will happen fast when they begin to happen. That was volume 11, number 7, July 1982. 8.8. Forces which are positive. What shames the entire right wing existing today is that Hitler outlined, step by step, what to do and how to do it in Mein Kampf. Nobody since Rockwell and Tomasi has had the guts and the gumption to do it. Hitler also told us within the pages of Mein Kampf precisely how to spot the right man, our best friend, at a glance, and we have for the most part failed to heed his guidance in that as well. What propelled Hitler and his movement in Germany ever forward was duty, love, and devotion, all of which were applied under the most expert management, doing the best one can do given the circumstances of the moment. Yet allowing for what happened in 1923 and 1945, we must always bear in mind that even the best, most inspired efforts may be overwhelmed. Right-wing hate and paranoia won't make it and cannot hope to form the basis of a movement. The power and force trip won't make it either, for the movement is powerless. Social-political tunnel vision, being too close to our work, is fatal because everything must be taken and viewed in balance with everything else. Someone said that we are operating in a vacuum. We are not. A better way of putting it is that we are starring in our own movie. There must be total awareness, not partial ignorance. There must be absolute love for our own kind, plus an abiding respect for all nature. There must be the spirit of sacrifice, something which was always at a premium in the right, and which is now all but evaporated. Because we were hyped on the paramilitary approach, because we saw only narrowly, because we were ignorant of what was going on around us, because we were largely unaware, and because hate and paranoia were two of our main pillars, we lost track of events after 1967. That is, when we lost our leader, Commander Rockwell. The very year of Rockwell's death, a new path was being blazed 3,000 miles away on the other side of the continent. Two very short years later, in 1969, it burst upon the world as few things have done before, and it remains alive and in full force with us today. Even as National Socialists, we have been blinded and have proven equally vulnerable to system media misrepresentation, every bit as much as the cursed and despised masses, the goyim. We are fully capable of being just as bigoted and prejudiced as the Jews and the liberals claim we are. It took me fully 12 years to really wake up and see that here is a man in a movement with all the right credentials that Hitler himself specified, and which has to qualify positively as the system's, quote, most reviled. Volume 10, number 9, September 1981. 8.9, Power to Blow Nazis' Minds. We were supposed to be the ultimate mind blow, and indeed we were, until after the death of Rockwell. Still in all, at the best of times, we labored and struggled under the stigma of un-American, again because of the past. The commander sat up most nights, painstakingly devising ways to shock the pants off of complacent Americans. One man succeeded in doing this without so much as trying. There is only one man and one group of followers who can conceivably be considered as being smeared as much, if not more so, than Adolf Hitler and his Nazis in Germany. And, it is important to note, smeared by the selfsame people. With Jewry and its accomplices all triumphant at the close of World War II, and with the Nuremberg trials as a precedent, can the outcome of any head-on clash between this man and his followers in the system, especially in 1969, be doubted? The system is as fearful as it is vengeful. At a closer look, if, as anyone will agree, true leadership is a pyramid, then the fact that nothing of a positive epoch-making nature is happening currently has an easy explanation. The leader is jailed, and the pyramid is thus turned upside down. Today's right wing is notoriously made up of born losers, while the party in Germany was composed of born winners. Only Hitler himself, by virtue of an extremely fortuitous genetic combination, might have been taken as a loser during his 30-year apprentice period, but yet rose to the top as the leader of leaders. One man today rose to the top of a group of people taken mainly from society's elite upper crust, whose own origins were something less than modest. The time, the place, the wrappings are different. The phenomenon is the same. Hitler and Rockwell stressed the importance of appealing to the young. This man did so as naturally as he did it dynamically. Reality is emphasized. Wishful thinking negated. The traditional right has the stigma of being sexually hung up. It was women who voted Hitler into power, and it was Commander Rockwell who said, "A man who won't fuck, won't fight." One person today has a reputation for having declared war on sex hang-ups. Rough, back-to-nature survivalism was being practiced in the 1960s. Rather than a stag milieu, this group was made up of men, women, and their children. Only whites were permitted. Jews were recognized for what they are. Environmentalism was practiced, and war was declared against polluters and exploiters in the 1960s. Death to the system sucks and Hollywood phonies was practiced. And a system lynching took place. Volume 10, number 9, September 1981. So he's trying to get people to conceive Manson differently from the way he's presented in the Jews media and see him as someone who embodied a lot of the things that Rockwell and Hitler said make a true leader. 8.10, the truth is one. The one truth came to be called National Socialism by Adolf Hitler in 1919. Today, under a different setting, it might be called Universal Order, or something of the like. No one has a monopoly on the truth, and no one has a monopoly on the proper modus operandi. Do it. The proper MO is, do it. No one is invulnerable to the common pitfalls like blabbermouth on the inside. Anyone who really hits the system can expect to be hit back. And when it involves the system's president, who publicly voices the thumbs down before any trial has taken place, then you know it must be of a unique nature for sure. I am no kind of a sucker for a bandwagon or a con game of any sort. The fact is that, after doing my own trip for over 12 years while all this other was transpiring, almost totally oblivious to it all, I stumbled onto a discovery similar only to the discovery I made when I bumped into Adolf Hitler, the real one as opposed to the media-created one which everyone is aware of. And, as with that earlier discovery, I proceeded to check it out thoroughly. To first read all the system trash available on it, and then to unravel and separate truth from lies, to get to know the actual people involved, rather than to take someone else's word for it, to begin to get personally involved in it myself and start to become identified with it, not giving a damn what anyone else said in their ignorance, cared or said. The experiences and feelings that I went through during the last fall and winter after making the acquaintance of Charles Manson and members of his family, capital F, can only be compared to those I went through after first becoming a National Socialist and dealing with the rest of the world as such. It was and remains a special kind of feeling. To sum it up, I quote from one family member who commented after I had introduced her to the books of George Lincoln Rockwell, for she was already familiar with Mein Kampf, where Rockwell stops, Manson begins. Of the two groups, ours and Manson's, theirs is the more current and up-to-date. Psychologically and in coming to grips with, mentally, with the nature of the situation, they are way ahead of us. Practically and operationally, we are ahead of them. It can only be compared to making contact with another intelligence in the universe. What has your science learned? They are leery only of individuals, not of the world and the situation itself, as so many in the right are. They expected ultraviolence and blood and guts from us, just as I was told by the Jewish media to expect of them. The basis of our idealism is practically the same, whereas our redneck and cultivated, quote, macho image makes us out to be barbarians. It sounds a little off, but the basis of our idealism is practically the same, whereas our rednecks and cultivated macho image makes us out to be barbarians, the preponderance of women in the Manson family, though no less action-minded, gives them a lot more of a religious, quote, apart quality. They are, in fact, very moral, quaint in many ways, naive in some ways, polite, soft-spoken, but more fiercely dedicated than most I've known calling themselves National Socialist. They are scrupulously honest. They bewilder me at times. They are very, very slick. They are keenly intelligent and usually know what you're about to say before you say it. They resent the image made for them by the media far, far more than we resent the one that has been made for us. We laugh at and enjoy ours while they are outraged and indignant over theirs. When dealing honestly and openly with them, as I always have done, we get along together magnificently. Lying and holding back or the playing of phony ego and personality games with them is detected immediately and is held up before one just like a mirror. Racially, they are all tops. Maybe when we speak of the kind of person and mentality of the future, we are actually talking about these kind of people. No one reading Siege should allow any of this to shock them or become dismayed in any way, for I have been of the same mind since before the first Manson contacts were made. We have our areas of disagreement. I can present no hard and fast conclusions at this time. Certainly no drastic changes in course are contemplated. I do know that circumstances are removing options fast, and that our course and the Manson course seem to be converging. Manson acted in 1969, and the understanding and appreciation of that act stands at about zero. It is now 1981, and he is still there and watching. I was asked by one, "What took you so long?" I had to stop and think about my answer before I could give it. I felt like a novice, a dumbass kid. You can't bullshit these people. We were separated by 3,000 miles and were developing in our own worlds with one huge difference with once huge differences which have shrunk drastically over the years. We have essentially arrived at the same place, having come across widely divergent paths. We have a lot to offer one another. And the enemy, just as the truth, is the same. Volume 10, Number 9, September 1981. 8.11, Charles Manson. They'll say that you can't have anything to do with such a criminal, such a defective, such a pervert, such a monster. The lesson of history is clear, and the method of the Jew is exposed for those with the understanding, the intelligence, and the courage that it takes to put it to use. For the rest, they write themselves off right away, as easily as that. The revolution is going to call for people who will think, "To hell with all that other. What has he to say?" For when they exclaim, "To hell with the other," they mean the whole system, everything it says, and everything it stands for. They then stand at the beginning. Adolf Hitler was unable to do this because at his time he was able to work within that system, but, in doing so, may have engendered his own ultimate end. Those who cannot, under any circumstances, accept or even try to accept Manson are unconscious of the fact that, in reality, this means they cannot accept their own reflections. They are then severely crippled, just like the Jews say they are, and not only useless to themselves or anyone else, but that same kind of liability to anything they may get into, as I have attempted in many various ways to outline and illustrate in Siege over the years. Even in the hostile Jewish system, accounts of the Manson family, you'll find no dregs or cripples such as abound in the right wing, only the best from among the best, racially and otherwise, profoundly alienated by a Jew system, just as it was with the NSDAP in Germany. There is the immediate rise of, "What about all those drugs?" Part of the legend and lore of the kosher myth-building machine. First, speaking for myself only, I have never used drugs and never plan to. Not only do I not feel I require them for any reason, I feel they are detrimental to the faculties, both mental and physical. Second, I have had explained to me by people who are drug-wise that there is a differentiation between natural substances, such as grass, and certain hallucinogens and the rest of the broad drug spectrum. It was that spectrum of addictive, manufactured drugs that Manson specifically forbade among his circle. But, just from a practical point of view, you tell a young white kid he must get his hair cut and give up grass, etc., and you're going to lose him to the other side, who will be thinking to themselves, rightfully, just what a jerk you are. We will interior decorate only after we have extinguished the house fire. Same goes for sex practices, as long as it is kept white, just as Manson insisted. Last of all, as could easily be deduced from my shotgun blast against any form of religiosity earlier in Siege, I go for nothing. Indeed, I have no tolerance for anything remotely spooky. All of this is real. It is solid. It is as American as apple pie, and it only may seem strange on the surface because it is so new. Manson, like Hitler, is as human as you or I. He is just special by virtue of a 1 in 100 million shot of gene combinations, which gives him his ideas, his personality, and his physical presence. So, children, be as naughty as you like, but don't be afraid. Volume 11, Number 11, November 1982. And that's where we'll conclude this segment, and we'll finish up Section 8 on leaders next time. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon.